for listening to A Little More Conversation. I'm Ben O'Hara Byrne. Tonight, Alan Cross, the host of the ongoing History of New Music, is with me to talk about the life, death, and legacy of Kurt Cobain. The Nirvana lead singer and songwriter took his own life in Seattle on April 5th, 1994. We look into why his music still rings so true 30 years later. Once a source of real national pride, our healthcare system is now a national concern. What is wrong and how can you fix it? Physician and former federal health minister Jane Philpott offers up her prescription in a new book called Health for All, and she's with me to explain her ideas. But first, tens of millions of people across North America were plunged into midday darkness on Monday as a total solar eclipse moved across an arc beginning in southern Mexico through the U.S. and into Ontario, Quebec, and Atlantic Canada. We catch up with some seasoned eclipse chasers who were there to witness it once again, some first-timers about what it was like, people who stayed put and got clear skies, and others who had to do a little more running around. And we look into why witnessing a total eclipse can be such an emotional and psychologically significant moment for some, prompting them to make sure it is not a once-in-a-lifetime experience. Did you see it? Did you manage to see even a partial eclipse? It was cloudy where I was in Victoria. I mean, like, so cloudy you couldn't see it. So there was nothing to see. I had to watch it online, which I did. It was amazing to hear people cheer and get so excited about the total eclipse. And of course, as you well know by now, it passed right across Mexico and the U.S. and into Canada today, darkening skies along its path. Cheers broke out on the beach at the Mexican resort city of Mazatlan as the solar eclipse began to cut its path across North America. Have a listen.
It's incredible. It's the sun, the sky. It's the most beautiful thing I have ever seen.
Yeah, there was a lot of that going on today. I know over the weekend, people were getting a little grumpy about it, like, ah, enough about the eclipse. But when it happened, people were just, you know, found it jaw-dropping. Many of us, weather permitting, of course, got to see a partial eclipse, but totality cut quite the swath right through parts of southern and eastern Ontario, Quebec, New Brunswick, Prince Edward Island, Nova Scotia, and Newfoundland and Labrador. Here's what it sounded like at Kingston's Lake Ontario Park as totality arrived around 3:22 p.m. local time. Yeah, that's the sound of excitement, let me tell you. Further east, the weather cooperated a bit more. Here's what it sounded like in my hometown of Montreal as the eclipse reached its darkest for about a minute and a half around 3:26 p.m. Wow. Yeah, it was something. If you see the pictures too, people were just having a blast, especially the kids. Let's move a little bit down Highway 10 from Montreal to a place called Sherbrooke, Quebec, where at 3:26, totality began a minute later. For 3 minutes and 26 seconds, it began a minute later at 3:27 p.m. That was the longest in Canada, and that's where my next guest traveled to, all the way from San Diego. Evan Zucker and his wife, Paula Eisenhart, brought 12 cameras, 10 tripods, 3 telescopes, all the way from Southern California. They changed their travel plans a lot before they landed on Sherbrooke, Quebec. And he joins me now from there. Evan, thank you so much.
Hi, thank you.
Well, I mean, you made a lot of different plans over time. Did you pick the right place finally?
We finally did. The year in May, again, 30 kilometers, making it 10 minutes, so that you could have some high clouds that were coming in from the southwest, and the forecast said it'll hold on until after totality, and then thankfully they did. So it was perfectly clear and beautiful where we were in Atascosa Corner.
Right. Did you manage to get all your gear set up? Did you get all that stuff ready to go in time?
We did. Well, we got there at 7 a.m., so we were there.
That'll do it.
7 hours early. You never want to be late for an eclipse. So while it took 2 hours or so to set it up, we had plenty of time to get that done in time.
Great. What was it like? I mean, you've seen more than a few eclipses over the years, total eclipses, I know, but I know a lot of people around you wouldn't have. They must have been curious about all your stuff and where you'd come from and all of that.
They were, and it was a great experience. My wife and I had scouted out, and we found this farmer's field that we thought would do well for us. And then I spoke to the landowners and my broken high school French, because they didn't speak English, and they kindly allowed us to use the land there. But we were a little disappointed that it meant we were going to be all by ourselves. It's nice to be around other people. But fortunately, a few of my friends who were looking for a place were allowed to come join us. And a lot of the neighbors, a lot of the people who lived at the residence in Ascot Corner joined us as well, English-speaking and French-speaking. And so it was great. Most of them had never seen an eclipse before, and some of us had. So it was wonderful sharing that with everybody.
Yeah, I've been to Ascot Corner. That's not an easy place to find if you've never been to the Eastern Townships.
Well, Sherbrooke was a little easier. And what we did is once we finally settled on Sherbrooke, as we went on Google Maps, that we were looking at different places, like a vineyard or by a lake or a field. And we drove around to look at the places we saw. My wife had identified this particular spot. And when we drove there, we thought, yep, this looks like a good spot for us. And, we're used to going to obscure and out-of-the-way places, especially in Canada. Usually we go to the Yukon and British Columbia and Alberta and the Northwest Territories, but this is only the second time I've been to Quebec.
Yeah, that's a little, Ascot Corner is still a little easier to get to, though, if I remember correctly. It's right off the highway, more or less, right? Yeah.
So the first time I was in Quebec was also for a total solar eclipse, 1972, on the Gaspé Peninsula, and that was the only one I was ever clouded out on. So I finally broke my Quebec curse of today's eclipse.
Wow, 1972. So you've been doing this for a long time, Evan.
Yeah, my first one was 1970 when I was 14 years old. And then in 1972, a group of us from high school in New York City chartered a bus and went up to Kachat.
Right, in the Gaspé. So this was all in all a successful. So what next? Are you off to where's the next one that you'll be off to?
Well, first we got to drive another 5,000 kilometers to get back home.
That's right.
The next eclipse anywhere in the world is in 2026 in Iceland and Spain. I love Iceland. I was stationed there for a year with the Air Force. Not a great place for good weather. I mean, you wouldn't have expected Quebec to be either, but you never know. The very good prospects are the following year in 2027 in Luxor, Egypt. A very long eclipse, and it's not likely to be cloudy in Egypt in August.
Yeah, I've been to Luxor. It's very rarely cloudy in Egypt. So that's right. You have to drive all the way back to San Diego. So was it worth the journey? I suppose that's the one question. Was it worth the journey?
Of course. What was special about this one is it's the last eclipse I'll ever be able to drive to. I'll be too old to be doing long driving in 2044, 2045, and the next two come back. So it was certainly worth doing that. And my wife and I like adventure, and this is certainly an adventure even by our standards.
Well, Evan, thanks for your time. I'm glad you found a great spot in Little Ascot Corners, and have a safe drive back to San Diego. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
And there it is, complete totality here in, wow. I've never seen anything like this before. This is my first total eclipse. It is truly, truly stunning. It takes a lot to stun me, I'll be honest. And this is just truly remarkable.
Reporter Matt Rivers there, at a loss for words, as a matter of fact. He was in Mazatlan in Mexico. That's kind of where the totality began and cut its nice arc right across the U.S. and into Canada, down into the Maritimes. Niagara Falls was expecting close to 1 million visitors on Monday. We, of course, spoke to the tourism folks there last week about just how much they were getting prepared. Once-in-a-lifetime event, of course. It was a bit cloudy. Perla Reyes was on the New York side of the falls. She traveled from Atlanta, but yeah, she was maybe regretting the journey.
We were second guessing our what we were thinking, because our family was sending us pictures from Atlanta. We're like, man, we traveled all the way over here. But just seeing how it got dark, that was an experience that, you know, it's like unforgettable.
There you have it. My next guest is also someone who's witnessed a whole lot of natural phenomenon, good and bad, over the years. And he also began his day in Niagara Falls, as far as I can tell. And judging by his photos from the shores of Lake Erie later, he did manage to find a great spot to witness totality. Anthony Farnell is chief meteorologist with Global News. He joins me now. Anthony, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me on, Ben.
What a cool day. I sort of followed you. Did you start the day in Niagara and then sort of hightail it somewhere else?
Yeah, I mean, we left just after 5 a.m. thinking that the roads were already going to be jammed, and the crowds were a bit slow to build in Niagara, and I think part of that was the state of emergency, part of that was the forecast for overcast skies, but we did manage to spend the first half of the day there. We did our noon broadcast, our weathercast from there, and then we just kind of made the decision, okay, this is a once-in-a-lifetime type experience. Yeah. I want to get the most out of it, so let's try and do this 30-40 minute drive, get closer to Lake Erie. We knew there was this line of clearing that was advancing towards us, and it was just a matter of timing. Would it arrive just in time for totality? And it actually, the clouds started to break right as that was occurring, and it kind of added to our experience versus it just being a beautiful clear day, which others had in other parts of that path.
Yeah, I'm surprised that if people noticed you, recognized you, they didn't all just get into like a convoy and follow the meteorologist wherever he happened to be going.
Yeah. I mean, roads were also shut down around Niagara, so it wasn't easy to get around by afternoon. And there were a lot of no parking signs on some of the highways. They were expecting bigger crowds, I think, across the entire region. But even still, I know there were some network issues, some Rogers communication problems today. But I think the amount of people in that area meant that we went windows of about an hour or two where we couldn't even get a phone call out, and I was trying to do some other radio shows earlier, and that was the frustrating part, that along with trying to find the sun, which is the opposite. You mentioned these other chases that I've done. Normally it's for the darkest clouds, the hurricanes, yeah, the tornadoes, and in this case it's literally trying to find that window, that small opening in the sky where you can witness this 3.5 minute phenomenon.
What was it like? I mean, again, you've seen a lot of stuff. What was it like to witness a total solar eclipse, or just about?
Yeah, I've never been in that path of totality. So that was something that, I mean, people can hype up events and you get maybe sometimes overly excited. I kind of knew what to expect. I knew it would come at us quickly. But even with everything I've researched and the videos I've seen, I didn't imagine seeing this almost wall of darkness approaching from one side, and that gets accentuated when you're out over a body of water, and we were right on a point. It's this place called Long Beach, basically right there in the middle of Lake Erie, and you could see it coming from one way, and then it moved right overhead. The birds all just went up and started going crazy. People were cheering, and then it just was 3.5 minutes, but it felt like only a few seconds, how fast everything moved, even though your body seemed more relaxed than ever.
Yeah, I find that incredible, because I've heard that again and again and again today. People who are even just a little bit skeptical saying it was just, you have to see it. You have to see it to describe it.
That's exactly it. And that you had to really be in that path of totality. There were effects elsewhere. If it was clear and you saw anywhere else in Canada where part of the sun, it's great. It's worth seeing, having those glasses on. But when you're in that path of totality and the temperature starts to drop, and even if you were in some of the overcast conditions, still almost nightfall in the middle of the afternoon is something that you're going to remember for a long time. And I think the people, the hundreds that I was with on that beach, are all going to remember. And we almost are asking each other, okay, where can we get this fix again sooner than, say, 2044 out in Alberta, which is when the next Canadian one will be.
Yeah, apparently they are addictive. What was it like right across the swath in Canada? Did it stay? I saw that the weather was pretty decent in Montreal and Sherbrooke. What was it like sort of overall? Did the weather cooperate today for the most part?
For the most part, yes. I mean, April isn't the best of times. Climatologically speaking, there was about a 60 to 70% chance of cloud cover any given spot on this Canadian route from southern Ontario through Quebec into New Brunswick. And then Newfoundland was almost guaranteed to be cloudy, and they ended up with some rather nice viewing spots as well. So southern Quebec and New Brunswick, I think, were the best locations. Where I was, southern Ontario over towards the south end, Leamington, those areas also had clear skies. And then it was just Niagara through Toronto. Kingston was also pretty good, but with high clouds around. So it was not just the amount of cloud cover, but the type of cloud. Was it created with ice crystals, which are a bit more translucent and you can see through them? Or was it the thicker, lower clouds that would block out the sun completely. And wherever you were, it was an experience for sure to remember.
Yeah, you have that great picture of what looks like sort of almost the whole horizon with a sunset. That was remarkable looking.
That I never expected. And I think that had partly to do with the fact that there was this cloud cover and it was clearing right overhead. But yeah, it was dark overhead. And then I looked around fully 360 and you're seeing what would be basically 20 minutes after the sun sets on the horizon. But it was everywhere you looked. And it lasted for a couple of minutes. And then already the light conditions started to change. And there were fireworks actually going off along the beach as well. It was pretty surreal.
Well, Anthony, I'm glad you made the move. Thanks so much for sharing that with me. I appreciate it. Have a great rest of your night.
Thanks a lot, Ben.
Needless to say, that song shot up to number one on the iTunes chart, both in Canada and the US today, eclipsing all other tunes on the charts. No surprise, of course, Total Eclipse of the Heart. Apparently, there were some places in Texas where the length of Totality was about the same as the length of the song. So you could actually play the whole song through the Totality if you wanted to accompany it that way. I'm not sure that's such a great idea. That wasn't the only sound enjoying the spotlight today. There was lots of stuff online about the sonification of how much light was coming from the sun. And I'd never seen this done before. And it was sort of to give you an idea just by listening what was happening with the eclipse. Have a listen. It's quite strange, by the way. I warn you in advance. Yeah, that was the sonification of the eclipse. And that's sort of the sound of the sun. I'm not quite sure how it worked, but there was lots of it out there. So you could actually follow the sort of the path of the moon as it began to cover the sun. And then the sounds became less and less and less as there was less and less light. So lots of interesting stuff going on out there today. I, of course, was in Victoria. It was raining. It was cloudy. You couldn't see a thing. So I watched it online. But man, did people get excited today, which was great to see. Obviously, Carol Giangrande and Brian Gibson have been eclipse chasing for 45 years. The couple is visiting Kingston to witness their fifth eclipse. Giangrande says it is always a wonderful experience.
So much in the world right now is so rotten. It gives you such a feeling of positivity and people enjoying themselves and wonder. It's beautiful. It's something really beautiful to see. There's no human experience that can match it. You can't explain it to anybody. You just have to experience it.
The couple's first eclipse was back in 1979. They were in Gimli, Manitoba. Kat, if you're listening, they were in your backyard. Of course, I think Manitoba in 79 had completely clear skies. I was chatting quickly with Alan Cross, who's on with us later in the show, and he saw his first eclipse as a kid back in Manitoba in 1979 as well. And I think everyone has fantastic memories of that. If you saw the eclipse today, total or partial, and you have something you want to talk about, let me know. 1-877-399-9898 is the text line. 1-877-399-9898. Their trips, Carol and her husband Brian, have brought them all over the place to Manitoba, now to Ontario, the U.S., including all across the U.S. and in New Mexico, amongst others. I was curious today, though, because Anthony Farnell, Global's chief meteorologist, mentioned it earlier, after witnessing Totality, they started to talk to each other, but not wanting to wait another 20, 30, 40, 50 years to see another one. Why not go see another one sooner? Because they tend to become, not for everyone, but they tend to become quite addictive, or so I'm told, because I've actually never seen one. So I was wondering, as Totality crossed the paths of so many people today, from southern Mexico right up through the U.S. into Canada, how many young and old today witnessed this for the first time and thought, wow, I would really love to see this again. Now, to give you an idea of just how excited people got, there was perhaps no scene quite as excitable as the one in Fredericksburg, Texas. This is the Weather Channel's Stephanie Abrams.
Totality, we're in it and we're behind a cloud. But I still want you to appreciate the darkness that we are experiencing. And by the way, our temperature has dropped. We're down to 72 degrees. I can even see a blue spot right there. Come on. We've got 4 minutes. The crowd is willing it. Yes! Whoa! We can see it. Just for a minute. Just for a second.
I mean, really, that takes the cake, doesn't it? But that's just how excited people were to see it. And again, I was mentioning earlier over the weekend, I saw some people being sort of grumpy about it online. Oh, I don't care about the eclipse, blah, blah, blah. And he thought, hey, listen, if you can't park that, if you can't park the cynicism for a second and just appreciate the wonder and get down with the rest of the crowd enjoying it, then come on, like, just enjoy it. It is for many a once-in-a-lifetime experience for those who either can't or won't get the chance to go see one somewhere else. My next guest witnessed her 14th total eclipse today. She was also in Texas, but she also happens to be a psychologist. So for years now, not only has she been a devoted eclipse chaser, she's also tried to look into the psychology of why people get so passionate about watching total eclipses. What is it about them that really captures the imagination, perhaps more than any other celestial phenomenon? As I mentioned, Kate Russo, author, psychologist, eclipse chaser. She's the founder of a group called Being in the Shadow, and she joins me now. Kate, thank you so much for your time tonight.
Oh, thank you. Like, it's just nice. It's nice to hear what happened in Canada.
Indeed. A little bit of cloud. Like, as always, you're kind of at the mercy of Mother Nature when it comes to these things. How was it where you were?
Well, in Texas, we were expecting to have the best weather along the path. Well, you know, we were under cloud in Texas. But in the end, I made the decision in the afternoon to stay where I was, stick with my plan A. And I was viewing here in Garner State Park, which is one of the most popular parks in Texas. And it just coincidentally happens to be in the eclipse crossroads from the October annular eclipse and this eclipse here. And I did a big two-day event here in the park for the annular. And so I sort of felt I wanted to experience it with the guys who really went all out. And I'm so glad I did. I am so glad I did.
How was it? Because, I mean, I guess you want the ideal conditions, right? And there were some in Eastern Canada and so on where it was clear skies, I believe, and people got to ooh and ah and see it in all its glory. You've seen them before, obviously. So what was it like where you were today?
Yeah, it was interesting. I think I did a briefing today at 9. And in fact, I've done briefings the last 3 days, just sort of getting the expectation management, the idea that it will be cloudy. What we have to expect is that we won't, you know, that we'll get glimpses of it. And that, you know, the totality experience happens above you, around you, and within you. So I was kind of priming people that you wouldn't get the visuals from above, but you will still get the around you, you know, the light changes, the drop in temperature, the eerie light, the darkness that comes, that ominous feeling, the nature quietening down. And boy, did we have that. That was really good. Through the morning, there were pockets of sunshine. So every time the sun shone, you know, like, it was really good, but it was pretty quick. But first contact, it was so amazing because it was almost like the clouds parted. We watched first contact and then they closed again. And then in the moments before totality, again, it's like the clouds really thinned and we were able to see, we couldn't see the Bailey's beads or the diamond ring or anything, but we could see totality. And it was just amazing to actually have that thinning so we could see that. And that happened several times. So we were able to get repeated glimpses of it and not enough that you could see the corona. Like it was just too hard to see that. But it was special. And it looked huge. I don't know whether it was just the clouds or not, but it just looked so huge. And, you know, we had 4 minutes and 26 seconds of totality here. And what I noticed was the darkening. I was just trying to draw everyone's attention to what I could see. And the darkening in the sky, we couldn't see it coming towards us, but we actually, because there's a hill right there, but around us, like, it got really, really dark. And the park superintendent, Kelby Bridwell, he was actually right beside me. And while I was looking at the totality that just, you know, filtered into view, he turned around and he looked at that view that is behind me here, over the park, and he saw the shadow racing out.
Oh, wow.
Now, that's his first total eclipse, and I've never quite seen it in that particular way. And he got to see that, and that was so special.
I mean, you've seen so many of these over the years. How many is it? 13? Is it what was the? I was trying to remember the number.
This will be number 14 now.
Oh, wow.
I feel so privileged and lucky to be seeing this and experiencing it again. And I think actually the fact that it was cloudy and we had low expectations, so there's none of that amazing transformational awe that you have, but I feel incredibly humbled. And it might be because I've been up on this mountaintop on my own. Everyone, after totality, everyone went.
Right, as they want to do. Everyone, the show is over, right?
I am literally on my own, and I've been here talking to the world. I've been, you know, doing interviews and in Australia and the UK and across America. And
yes.
So I've been sort of sharing the feeling of it and the emotion of it, but humbled, really humbled.
That's one of the things that I've actually never seen a total eclipse. I have to confess, but I've talked about them a lot now. And one of the two things that keep coming up is look around you, because it's not just what's happening above, it's what's happening around. It's the reaction of people, of nature and so on. And as you mentioned, the chilliness and the darkness and all those things. And also just that sense that you get, how it's hard to describe. I guess, well, I'll let you describe it. It is in every which way awesome, right?
Yeah, and awesome just does not cut it, does it?
No.
And it's one of these things that's ineffable, which means that we just cannot convey the experience. Some people are really good at putting words, their feelings and emotions into words. Other people struggle. I struggle. But, you know, I've been doing research over the past 10 years of, you know, initially I was doing surveys with eclipse chasers, then really detailed interviews with eclipse chasers with my phenomenological research. And that really delves deep into how people make sense of their experiences. So even with that, we're able to identify that there is a sequence of things that we all seem to experience during totality. First, we pick up that sense of wrongness. Something's not quite right in the environment. And then there's that primal fear as the darkening sort of happens. And I felt that today, even though it was a cloudy eclipse, it was just so eerie and dark. Dark just keeps coming up, but it was dark. And, that primal fear is that sense of real ominous foreboding, something big is coming this way. And of course it is. It's the moon's shadow. And yeah. We know it's coming, but it still surprises us. The feelings of connectedness, but feeling insignificant as well as part of the greater world and universe. And that euphoria that we feel. I mean, it's just insane how excited you get. And then we couldn't quite mark the end of totality. It was actually hard for us to see because we didn't see the end. But you could tell the lighting that returned. You know, suddenly it's just sort of like back to daylight. You could just see it over the valley across. And, oh, do you know, I'm just speechless.
it's what's remarkable about it is obviously, you know, you look back into ancient history and how people in the past, when even they had, you know, rudimental understanding of astronomy and so on, we're awed by it. You can think back to prior to that, but here we are, 2024. It feels like there are no mysteries or very few mysteries these days, and yet this still has the power to leave people like yourself and millions of others at a loss for words.
It's just something that it's one of these things that you just have to experience yourself. You really do, and hopefully, yep, people understand that there is a difference between being in the path of totality and outside. Because the partial eclipse is interesting, and there's everyone across America would have experienced, and Canada and Mexico would have experienced a partial eclipse today if they were able to see the sky. But it's the ones in the path of totality, that's the thing, that is actually, it does make a difference. And that's why there's been eclipse news and coverage, because it really is a big deal. But you just don't know it until you've been there and seen it.
Kate Russo is an author, psychologist, and eclipse chaser. She's with us tonight from Texas, where she witnessed today's eclipse with some cloud. So, Kate, I mean, one of the things that I suppose in your case is that once you've seen one, you must get a bit of a, you must get hooked. I'm wondering how many Canadians are waking up today thinking, I really want to see that again. This isn't a once in a lifetime thing. I want to make this happen at least one more time.
Yeah, because that's what happened to me. I thought I was just going to get into the path of totality and see my first total solar eclipse. And, you know, just like you go somewhere for the first time and you just think, yep, been there, done that, done this, done that. I had no idea that it was going to be so impactful. I really, really didn't. And I didn't know that it was actually going to really change the way I think about my life and actually lead to this whole trajectory that I have now. And I will be an eclipse chaser forever, as long as I live. Every single total solar eclipse, I will have a default that I'm going to be there unless something happens that I have to, you know, that it's not possible.
Right.
So, but they're all very different and unique. Your first one is very special because it's, you think you know what's going to happen and then it blows you away. But it's an interest, you made an interesting point. because everybody who experiences a total solar eclipse, there's not everybody who then becomes obsessed about it. So it's that thing of why me versus my hubby, or why, yeah, you know, like I was really fascinated by that. You know, what is it in our personality, or is it the time that we actually see it? Is it the time of our life that we become, when it makes us think about our position in the world, are we more receptive to thinking about that way that then changes things, and then we can take a different trajectory? So there's just some really interesting questions about that.
It's a reminder that we still, even though that with all the other things that go on and the daily grind and politics and all the things we can see that are negative around us, it is that we never lose our capacity to wonder, or to have a sense of wonder. And that's what I think is so beautiful about it, even though I didn't get to see it.
Well, in 2026, on August the 12th, you will be able to get into the Path of Totality. So it goes over, it makes landfall in Greenland, Iceland, Spain, and the island of Mallorca. So, you know, us chasers, we know where the next ones are. And we have maps and globes and everything that tells us where we're going to be for the, you know, rest of our lives.
Australia is getting one too, right? Isn't Australia getting one in 2020, a little bit later this decade?
Well done for knowing, but actually we have 5 in 15 years.
Oh, wow.
We are the lucky country. And we just had the first one there in April last year. So it was a small eclipse and it only went through the westernmost tip of Western Australia. And it was 56 seconds of totality. And that's why this one was very different, because we had 4 minutes and 26 seconds. And it's we had a lot of time just to look around, you know. But then we have one in 2028, 2030, 37, and 38.
Oh, and the old hat. You'll be up to 20 before you know it.
Yeah, I guess so. I guess so. Yeah.
Last word to you, Kate, as always. Last word to you on witnessing this again today, walking away from this experience, because there was so much excitement about it because of just the sheer number of people that were going to be able to watch as it cut through Mexico and North America and so on.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's about, if there's one lesson, it's that we can never control things in our lives. We can't control everything. And we think we can make decisions and do the best we can with the information we have, but you know, the weather is really outside of everyone's control. So there was a mad scramble really for people to do what they did, and it's been exhausting. Like, this has actually literally been a chase, and there, you know, so I think there's a lot of exhausted eclipse chasers. There's probably a lot of excited people who've seen it for the first time, but I really feel for us chasers at the moment.
I spoke to another one on Friday. I'm like, you sound really stressed.
Yeah.
And they were because they were.
But that's that thing. And when I made the decision that I wasn't going to chase, you know, like I actually let that go and said, right, no matter what happens, I'm going to be here with the people around me that I've been involved with. And, you know, a lot of the angst actually went away. I didn't have to check the weather. I still did because I was doing the briefings for other people. But sometimes you just actually have to roll with it, and you have to accept that not everything is the way you want it to be, and that that's okay.
Life in a nutshell. Kate, thank you so much. Good luck. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Here's a question for you. Do you have a family doctor? Because millions of Canadians, of course, don't. And this has become an increasing problem in this country over time. Primary care is so important, and yet so many of us don't have a quick gateway to primary care. And this is kind of a telling trend, right? I mean, overall, if you ask Canadians these days about what they think about the state of the healthcare system, and keep in mind, I think most of us, if asked around the world, healthcare is one of those things that Canadians have always been proud of our public healthcare system. But according to a recent Ipsos poll, Canadians are twice as likely to expect the quality of healthcare that they and their family will have access to locally will worsen rather than improve in the next few years. So people are pretty pessimistic about what they're seeing out there. One of the big problems, of course, was revealed during the height of the pandemic, when it was obvious that the healthcare system came under incredible strain. We realized how hard healthcare, we always knew how hard healthcare workers work, but it also showed burnout and stress and all the things that were going wrong. It was already a fragile system, and the pandemic just poked more holes in that net. Now, of course, many cite the lack of healthcare professionals to meet demand as the main cause for their pessimism about the system, and it reaches beyond simply local care. Fewer people believe the healthcare system in general is providing good quality care these days. And one of the big issues, as I mentioned, is the number of us who do not have a family doctor. An estimated 7 million Canadians don't have a family doctor. And that's as millions of Canadians know this firsthand. Primary care or a lack of family physician is often where the problems with our system begin for us. Donna Jivanch spoke to Global News about her struggles recently.
I can't walk and I'm in constant pain. And I had no family doctor, otherwise I could have gone to see them. Anybody who has any sort of health issues, whether they've been ongoing or just new, if you don't have a family doctor, there's nowhere for you to go.
All of that despite the fact that it is still the biggest ticket item for taxpayer expenditure. Something like $344 billion was spent in 2023 on healthcare. That's about $8,700 per Canadian, about 12% of our GDP. And yet again, millions of us don't have access to a family doctor. ERs in smaller communities are constantly struggling with staffing. Others closed today. I believe I was reading about one in Haida Gwaii, an island in BC, where they've had to close their ER recently for a while at least. A burnout and other factors combined with lots of doctors hitting retirement age, not to mention the demands of an increasing population in this country. So how do you fix it? That is the $344 billion question. Dr. Kathleen Ross is the head of the Canadian Medical Association.
We need to be smart and reorganize and modernize how we deliver care so that we can utilize all the skill sets of all the healthcare providers to optimize patient care.
So what does that sound like in practice? Well, as my next guest puts it in a very comprehensive, easy to read and thought-provoking book that I was poring over this weekend, what we have now is a hodgepodge, a patchwork, an ad hoc smattering of healthcare delivery units, clinics, hospitals, and services where smart, compassionate people work tirelessly and loyally to deliver the highest possible standard of care within the conditions they've inherited. But she says, you can't call that a system. Because it's not. We've never really developed a system. And she says, quote, nowhere is this lack of systemic planning more obvious than in primary care, the foundation of any health system. As millions of Canadians struggle to find a family doctor or primary care team, the need for a coordinated national approach is ever more glaring. Well, those are the words of someone who's seen this issue surrounding healthcare in this country from just about every vantage point. Dr. Jane Philpott was a longtime family doctor. She's a former federal cabinet minister, including Minister of Health. She's now Dean of the Faculty of Health Sciences and the School of Medicine at Queen's University in Kingston. But what she's done with this is put out a new book that tackles this and tries to find some solutions to how we can sort of renew healthcare in this country, make it something we can all be proud of again. The book is called Health for All, A Doctor's Prescription for a Healthier Canada. Dr. Jane Philpott joins me now to discuss. Thank you so much for your time tonight.
Thanks for having me.
I mean, it feels like an important time. The 40th anniversary of the Canada Health Act is tomorrow, and it feels like a really important time to take stock of where we're at, because I think there's an overall sense in this country that while we're all very proud of the system, we think it's in crisis. Now, we're worried about it.
Exactly. I think there is a significant amount of despair, I would say, on the part of both Canadians as well as healthcare professionals who are the ones that are trying to solve this and keep things going on the front lines. But they recognize that something's not working. And I'm hoping that the book will give people hope that there are, in fact, some really great solutions available.
You mentioned something really interesting near the beginning of the book, and that is that we now have a two-tiered system. And I think when we use those terms, we always think of public and private, but you refer to it as access and lack of access, specifically to a family doctor or to primary care, someone you can pick up the phone when you're not feeling well.
Exactly. So we are divided into haves and have-nots. For people who have a family doctor or a primary care team, for the most part, it's an amazing experience. And that means somebody is caring for you over time. They're making sure that you're up to date on your screening. They're monitoring your blood pressure and diabetes over years. They're providing you with counseling when needed. But there's now almost a quarter of the population that doesn't have that. You know, it's close to 7 million people in this country that don't have a place to go when they're sick and nobody that's watching them over time. And that just leads to a whole lot of problems in the rest of the system. People are getting sick. You know, I'm hearing terrible stories of people who are showing up in emergency rooms with stage 4 cancer because they didn't have anyone who was looking out for them. And we've got to do better than that.
Yeah, there's some really poignant examples in the book itself of just what happens when you don't get, you know, just the struggles people have, even when they're diagnosed with something, not being able to get any follow-up or find any solace, and the kind of pressure it puts on the entire system.
Yes, and it, you know, it doesn't have to be this way. I think that it has happened so gradually to us that perhaps we've been a bit complacent and we sort of watched things deteriorate gradually, and then the pandemic hit and suddenly we realized, oh my gosh, you know, 7 million people without a place to get care. We didn't realize that there are other ways to do this, and that there are many countries in the world where literally everyone is attached to a primary care home. And we can do this in Canada too. We just need to put the pressure around the politicians and make sure that we invest in the right things to make healthcare better.
Few people are better placed than you are to understand this topic. You were for a very long time a family physician. You've sat on the politics and policy side of this as the Minister of Health. You're now the dean of a medical school, essentially. Where is the problem then? Because when one reads through your book, you think, well, that all makes perfect sense. And then you look out there and think, well, why isn't it? Why hasn't it happened? Because the ideas aren't necessarily new, but they're certainly urgent.
It's a great question. And I think some of our complacency arose because of the fact that, you know, we've always said Canada's got the best health system in the world. And what we really meant by that was Canada has had this amazing assurance that we had health insurance for everyone, so that if you needed to see a doctor or you needed to go to a hospital for medically necessary care, that would be covered, which is fantastic. And we've had that now for decades. We somehow thought that that translated to a national health system or an approach where everybody had access to care. But we've never intentionally built that first floor of the healthcare system, the primary care floor. And it's only recently, I think, become so obvious what's missing. Now we need to rally the vision of what's possible. I'm hoping the book will help people as they start to imagine what it could be like if in every single neighborhood there was a place where you were automatically attached. And when you moved to another community, you were automatically attached again to a new primary care home, because that happens in many parts of the world. And I know that we can do it here too.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that you point out that we don't, in fact, have a healthcare system by the very definition of it. We have an insurance system, so you can get the care if you can find it, and therein lies the issue.
Exactly. That's the reality, is that an insurance system is not actually a health system. We've had a very ad hoc way of deciding where primary care would be delivered. And a few provinces have tried a bit over the years. Here in Ontario, where I'm based, you know, for 20 years ago, there was something called primary care reform, and there was an effort to put some public funding into team-based care, but it was never rolled out completely. So about a quarter of the people in Ontario actually do are part of a family health team, and where it works, it's amazing. But the rest of the province doesn't have that. And in many cases, people technically have a family doctor, but because those family doctors are so overworked, and because they're not open enough hours and they're not part of a team, people don't actually have the access to care that will keep them healthy.
Every year, to keep the clinic running, you know, physicians are having to dump their own personal money into the clinic to keep it running. And it just gets to a point where it's, when is enough enough?
Dr. Jane Philpott is with us this half hour. Her book is called Health for All: A Doctor's Prescription for a Healthier Canada. Dr. Philpott, it was interesting looking through some of the challenges because they are many. So maybe we could begin with some of just the on the ground challenges with why so few doctors now, because you speak so fondly of your time in family medicine, but we hear more and more now about the administrative burdens, about the way the system is kind of set up. It disincentivizes young medical graduates from wanting to go into family medicine. What's happened to that calling, or at least that field of family medicine, which you derive so much, obviously so much joy, or at least sort of gratification out of when you were doing it?
Absolutely. So, you know, I speak in the book, and I'm sure you can speak to most family doctors across the country, and they will say to you, it's possibly the best job in the world. It's just such a pleasure and a privilege to be able to get to know people and their entire families and to care for them over decades. There are few vocations that could match that, but you're quite right that our graduates of medical school, fewer and fewer of them are choosing family medicine as their first choice specialty. And what's even more worrisome is of those who finish their family medicine residency training, fewer and fewer are actually choosing to do what We would describe as comprehensive family medicine, sort of the cradle to grave, take care of every part of the body, take care of everybody in the family. But people are going into these niche practices where they might just focus on a specific area. They're not truly generalist family physicians then. And, you know, there's a long list, and I suggest some of the ideas in the book as to why that's happening. But one of the things is that the conditions of work do not look very appealing. Young medical students look at the family physicians that are out there and they say, wow, that looks like an extremely hard job, and there's not a lot of relief on the horizon. So we need to change the conditions of work so that they will once again desire to become family doctors.
How do you do that? I mean, I understand there have been attempts, or at least there's been a recognition, it feels like, in the last several years, specifically accelerated by the pandemic, that family doctors, that it wasn't working, that whatever was the system was set up, because so many were retiring, new ones weren't coming in, that somehow the system was no longer attractive to young doctors, and that was a problem.
Well, there are a number of things that we need to do differently in terms of how we organize across each province. But one of the big keys is to work in teams. So I had the great privilege of being part of a family health team in Markham. And it's fantastic when you have got not just family doctors on your team, but nurse practitioners, physician assistants, nurses, dietitians, a social worker. Then you can actually provide the full service of care for people. And what that allows then is that it doesn't have to always be the family doctor that sees the patient. There are many things that I can do as a family doctor, but so can a nurse do it, or so can a physiotherapist do it, depending on what the problem is. So why not share the workload? See a doctor when you really need to see a doctor, but if not, see someone else on the team. That's, first of all, of course, more affordable, but those people often give much better care than the doctor does because they are specialized in that specific area of care. This is going to take a bit of organization to do this. It happens in spotty places across the country. We need to make this the norm, the national standard for what's expected.
I know this is probably a bad analogy, but I thought of it reading your book. I thought of it a bit like the food court. Like you go in and you don't, and depending what you want to have or what you need that day, you'll see someone different. And that setup, if it were to exist in every jurisdiction across the country, would be remarkable because you'd be able to handle so many things off the bat. I mean, is that a decent enough way of looking at it? You have all these different specialists, including family doctors, within one little spot that people in that community can rely on to be for as their first line of defense.
No, I think that's an interesting analogy. I'll have to percolate on that one for a little bit. But you're quite right. I think the reality is that there are certain basic things you need to have. And if I can use the food court analogy, you know, the coffee shop has to have coffee, right? But it may or may not have sandwiches. So, you know, every place that you go to has to have the basics. There have to be family doctors. Ideally, there are nurses and even better nurse practitioners. You know, not every family health team will necessarily have a social worker, although they're fantastic resource. And considering the amount of mental health issues there are, wouldn't it be great if there were a social worker in every family health team? So you're quite right. There needs to be some choice. There needs to be that ability to share the workload, but still have a team, a place where you feel at home. And when you walk into that family health team or that primary care home, people know your name and they've got your chart and they've kept your records for decades. They can, you know, they know who you're related to and they know you by name. That's what I desire for every Canadian to have.
Yeah. It's such an attractive idea as well, because I mean, to give people a sense of where the concept came from, Dr. Philpott, in the book, you often mention the idea of schools. We don't simply hope that teachers show up and set up a school and hope that people come and sign up and that there's enough room for everybody. School is a right, and we make sure that all kids have a place to go, regardless of where they live. And when they move, they just simply fall into another part of the system, right? Another institution. You see primary care operating in kind of the same way, and it's a really interesting concept. And it does operate that way. I mean, I lived in the UK for a while, and that's how it operates there.
Yes, exactly. So the UK example is a great one, but you know, this school metaphor, and I'm not the first person who came up with this. In fact, some of my colleagues wrote a fantastic report about this about 10 years ago, saying that's how we should design things. But, you know, I'm hoping the book will help more people to grab hold of the idea, because as soon as you hear it, you think, oh yeah, that makes so much sense. We don't have teachers graduate from teachers college and then say, you know, go work wherever you feel like it and rent a space and hire a See if you can get someone to be the principal or the to clean the floors. We actually hire them to be teachers, and that's what they do. So imagine if we actually had a system like that. And as in the UK and other countries, we said that according to your geography, this is your primary care home. It's just, down the end of the corner. And when you move, you don't have to keep driving back 3 hours to the town you used to live in because you're so afraid to let go of that family doctor there. So we have people crisscrossing the country. It doesn't make sense. We need to be able to build a sensible solution.
The grind day to day that we face in our work, it's really something that students see.
Dr. Jane Philpott is a former federal cabinet minister, including Minister of Health. She is now Dean of the Faculty of Health Sciences in the School of Medicine at Queen's University. Her new book is called Health for All, A Doctor's Prescription for a Healthier Canada. And it really looks into one of the issues that we've talked about on the show before. Millions of us, including myself living on Vancouver Island, do not have access to a family doctor. I do not have a regular family doctor that I can call on whenever. There's simply people here, retired, clinics have closed. It's pure gold if you have a family doctor on Vancouver Island these days, given the demand. And that's part of the issue. Primary care has become one of those big gaps in the system. And a lot of this book looks into how you would fix that, why you need to fix that. Dr. Philpott, to go to sort of into your days in politics and around the table, you point out that in the Romano report decades ago, people were already upset at the fact that, governments point the finger at each other all the time over these issues when Canadians, all they really want is solutions. Where is the hang up? You sat around that table. You've talked to provincial ministers as well. What is the problem behind the scenes? Why can't we sort this out?
Oh, boy, if you and I can figure this out today, it'll be a great thing. So, there are multiple reasons. Part of it is, politics is more divisive than ever. So that's going to make it challenging to do this, but I still believe it's possible. And, right now there are conversations on a bunch of other sectors about, does the federal government have the right to step in and a bunch of issues, but health is actually a shared jurisdiction. So people like to use the excuse that it's only the province's business, but in fact, it's different parts of health are the business of every order of government, and they have to cooperate. That's what Canadians want. So they have a different role to play, but they have to get together and agree on what the plan is. And the federal government absolutely has the ability to legislate, to set national standards, and thereby to be able to set the bar for what should be expected. And I propose in the book something called the Canada Primary Care Act, modeled after the Canada Health Act, where the federal government sets the standards, makes sure that there are resources that are channeled into this, but where the provinces and the federal government, and I say would say Indigenous governments as well, agree upon what should be expected. It seems that one of the barriers is that we've never set those standards and we've never legislated it. But many countries that do have universal access to primary care, it is grounded in a right to primary care that allows their citizens to know that that's what's expected and gives them a way to be able to hold their governments to account.
Since healthcare is such an important thing to so many people, every time we do surveys, people say healthcare is one of the most important factors, or problems with the healthcare system is one of the most important factors to them politically, nationally, policy-wise. And yet it feels like a lot of governments, whether they be provincial or federal, somehow don't like to wade too far into the waters that you're discussing here. And it's interesting. I mean, I don't know whether it's because it's not politically expedient or it feels too big or what it may be, but it feels like there is a lot of hesitation when it comes to actually making these sort of large-scale Canada Health Act type changes to the system.
That's for sure. This is bold. I mean, if someone were to say the next federal election, we're going to guarantee that every Canadian has access to a primary care home. Now, you've heard them say things like, we hope everyone will have a family doctor. We'd like to, we've put the money in so that it can happen. But to actually say, we're going to do this, we're going to follow through, we're going to legislate, we're going to provide the resources, and we're going to hold regional or provincial governments to account for it is not something that we've ever seen anyone do. And I think that it's necessary because, you're right, it's not going to be solved in a few years. Politicians generally are frightened to make promises of things that they can't accomplish in a four-year term. They think that if they can't demonstrate that progress, that they will be punished at the polls the next time around. So here's where Canadians all together can say, you know, we recognize you're not going to be able to establish a brand new system for universal access to primary care in 4 years' time, but please get started, get the work going. And then hopefully we'll see that people will be rewarded. And we've seen a couple of premiers right now who have run on a platform of healthcare. You know, so that encourages me. Wab Kanew, of course, in Manitoba, yeah. Tim Houston, Nova Scotia, they've run saying they're going to fix healthcare. So let's hope they're successful and let's hope they get rewarded for the efforts that they put in.
Right. And for a lot of Canadians now, I mean, 1984, we're celebrating the 40th anniversary of the Canada Health Act tomorrow. I think a lot of Canadians, including my, you know, I'm in my early 50s, a lot of us don't remember how much of a fight that was from the get-go to bring in even what we have now as what we call a healthcare system in this country. And that there needs to be a certain amount of courage and conviction. So it's both carrot and stick. And yeah, it takes a lot of work.
It sure does. And, you know, I'm not sure if you got this far in the book, but at the very end, I talk a little bit about Monique Bégin.
Yes, and, you do. Yes. You
know, I had the great privilege of meeting her. What an incredible icon of for Canada she was. And she had to really fight to get that Canada Health Act through. We take it for granted now, but it was not a foregone conclusion that that bill would be passed. It eventually was passed unanimously in the House of Commons 40 years ago. And we have depended on it now to make sure that all of us have had the assurance that if we needed medically necessary care in hospitals or by doctors, we would get it. We need a new Monique Bégin to push this Canada Primary Care Act across the line. We need somebody that's going to have the courage, that they're going to put up with the naysayers who don't believe it's possible. The only other options for us are not looking good. We'll be paying more for care and we'll be getting a lot worse outcomes.
Yeah. And as you mentioned, even back then, another part of this issue was the medical associations themselves, right? I mean, this wasn't overly popular. We're seeing something sort of not quite similar, but we're seeing some pushback from the dental associations over this new national dental care plan. This is always a many moving part, difficult, many different interests kind of negotiations. And it feels like, I mean, if you're not really ready to jump in the deep end, if you're just going to do little patchwork things again and again and again, it just never gets done.
Exactly. So you're right. It needs to be big and bold and ambitious, and it has to be 100%. Like getting to, you know, 90% of people having a primary care home is not good enough. Let's set our bar at 100%. We can get there. I think there's a way to do it to keep as many people as possible on side. You're right. Often physician associations can be a bit nervous about this, but I would say what I'm hearing from my physician colleagues now is everyone recognizes this is a problem. Physicians are not generally enthusiastic about giving up autonomy and their ability to choose where and how they practice. But I can tell you a lot of them would be happy to give up a bit of autonomy right now if it meant that somebody was actually helping to do the administrative work, if they actually could get a holiday and be able to work a reasonable amount of hours. The price that they're paying right now for autonomy is pretty high, and it sure makes it not attractive.
Yeah, I suppose we are seeing. Do you feel like things have changed in the past 10 years or so? I mean, since you were, I guess it's been 9 years now since you entered government, but do you feel like you're seeing a different attitude towards what needs to be done, or at least a willingness to try some more bold stuff out, given where we're at in 2024?
There is good evidence that we're starting to see a new willingness. And as I said, if you talk to young physicians and say, you know, do you want to keep things going as usual, where you work in fee-for-service models, and or some of these doctors that have thousands of patients to whom they are permanently obliged and can never get a break. Some of them are now starting to say, you know what, if you could put me in a salaried system where I could actually, you know, have a few benefits, but I could also get a holiday, I could also get a few days off, and I wouldn't be, you know, still looking at my computer screen at 10 o'clock at night, finishing off my notes for my patients. So there are ways that we can set up a better system that will make it more attractive for young physicians, and it will also provide better care.
Dr. Jane Philpott is the former federal minister of health. Her new book is called Health for All, A Doctor's Prescription for a Healthier Canada. It was interesting to look back at your time as having chaired the cabinet committee to bring Syrian refugees to Canada, which was a big priority for the government. The Liberal government was first elected back in 2015. And you saw that some clarity in how that was done and how it could apply here, and a timeline as well. So essentially, to get this done, to get a primary Canada Primary Health Act together and implement it, you need clear goals, clear direction, buy-in, and a timeline, right? And it sounds very simple, but it seems very hard to do.
Well, of course, business people have figured these things out long ago. And I wanted to, you know, as I put this sort of bold vision out there, I wanted to give people some assurances that governments can get big things done. And, you know, to be fair, getting 25,000 Syrian refugees to Canada is complicated, but it's not remotely as complex as building
The recipe was interesting, though.
Yes, exactly. So you have to set a specific goal. It has to be measurable. It has to be achievable. Part of what's necessary for that is building that public will. And this is what I really hope to be able to do by putting a vision in front of Canadians, is to say, let's all agree on what we want to do. What is our shared vision? Our vision is that every single Canadian will have access to a primary care home, just like every child has access to a public school. Once we've agreed on that vision, the public can push the politicians to be able to do it. We can set the standards and say it has to be team-based, it has to be accessible to everybody, you know, it has to be culturally safe care, whatever the standards are that we want to set. And, you know, we've got, there's information in the book about what those standards should be. And then we can actually see that provinces and the federal government will get together and work with municipalities and all of the other people that are necessary to get it across the line.
Do you worry at all? I mean, I suppose the first question would be, voters should then really, if we take this seriously, we need to hold politicians to account on this stuff.
Exactly. But, you know, we've known how to do that on other issues. And when, you know, the one thing that politicians are good at doing is when there is a broad public consensus as to what we want done, they eventually usually do pay attention. So I think we haven't had a specific enough ask until now. And that's why I'm hoping that this will be a very specific ask to say, this is what we want. We want the federal government to work on this. We want all of our provincial governments to work on this. Hey, we even want municipal and regional governments to work on this, because everybody actually has a role to play. And as we start to ask that and say, this is the bar we want to be the country that has 99.9% access to primary care. We know that there are countries in Europe that do this. Why can't Canada do it?
Do you worry at all looking at the terrain right now that there's sort of, there is this polarization that's happened that seems to infect absolutely everything? So before the idea is even out, people are sort of yelling about jurisdiction and so on.
There is polarization, but again, I think Canadians have sort of had it with these jurisdictional debates. At the end of the day, we simply want to know that we're going to get care. This is our money after all, right? It's not as if governments are being, you know, magnanimous and putting, you know, $200 billion into healthcare. They're spending our money on healthcare. So please, when you spend our money, attach some strings to it, set some standards, let Canadians know what we're going to get, because we're the ones that are writing the checks and handing it over. So I think we're at the point where people want to see results. They want to see politicians sitting down in a room together, first ministers meeting together, setting a goal for themselves, getting it across the line, stop arguing. People are dying while we wait.
2030 seems to be what you thought was a fair date. If we don't do this, and we didn't get into this, but if we don't do this, you see, and I think everyone else sees, this isn't going to solve itself, right? And that therein lies the issue. It's going to get worse.
No, exactly. And I, you know, maybe part of how we got to this mess is we like to think of ourselves as good people, as Canadians, and we're generous, and we, you know, we always want the best for one another. That goodwill and good intention is not getting us across the line. So it's time that we need a lot more than just the force of our good intentions. And it will get worse. We're seeing corporations stepping in saying, well, we'll take care of this piece of the puzzle and we'll provide a little portion of care that's completely disconnected from the rest of the health system. But nevertheless, there will be for-profit actors who will want to get involved. But if you look south of the border, you know that when you don't provide publicly funded universal access, you end up spending a lot more per capita and you actually get worse outcomes, lower life expectancies. And that is not the direction we need to go.
Yeah, you've pointed out that this is actually, this whole primary care system would actually be cheaper because it's upstream.
Exactly. And it makes so much sense, right? You know,
yeah, the stitch of time, right?
The stitch of time. The stitch in time, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, right? So, you know, you can either treat something when it's small and manageable and easily excisable, if it's a lesion, for example, versus you leave it and then it requires massive surgery and chemotherapy and all kinds of other things. And we keep waiting until things are much further advanced rather than either detecting early or ideally even preventing those conditions from getting worse, monitoring people's chronic illnesses over time so that they don't get worse. And the fact that we are not putting all of our energy into fixing this just shows that I think we're a bit lazy, actually. But we're going to pay for it in the end, and we're going to pay more if we don't do it right.
Dr. Philpott, it's a fascinating book. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks so much for your interest in it.
Our North, strong and free, invests in new surveillance capabilities for land, sea, and air in the north. It leverages Canada's world-class technology, including in AI and quantum, so we can stay ahead of the curve. It creates jobs, and importantly, it supports all those of you who serve.
That was the Prime Minister, obviously, in Trenton, Ontario today. As we were all getting set to talk about the eclipse today, it became known yesterday that they were going to make this big announcement in Trenton, Ontario, which I think was in the path of totality today. It happened this morning. But this was really we've been waiting for a few years for this new defense strategy, and here it came today. So he was announcing that Ottawa plans to spend $8.1 billion over the next 5 years on upgrading and modernizing the Canadian military with a particular focus on defending Arctic sovereignty. The challenges that the military faces in this country are well known. We were talking about them on Friday as we marked 75 years of NATO. A personnel shortage of around 15,000. A recent report says the state of the Canadian Armed Forces' combat readiness is growing worse, and almost half of the military's equipment is unserviceable. The biggest challenge, according to that report, was people shortfalls, technicians and support, and funding shortfalls, spare parts and ammo. So, the PM says they will they'll make $73 billion worth of investments over the next 20 years. That will get us to about 1.76% of GDP by 2030, which is still shy of the NATO ally or the NATO target of 2%, but it's a move essentially in the right direction. Again, with that focus on defending Arctic sovereignty, which we'll talk about. So how will they do that? New submarines, long-range missiles, an early warning aircraft, new vehicles adapted to frozen conditions in the north, along with Arctic satellite ground stations and setting up northern operation hubs. Here's the Prime Minister.
The Northwest Passage could become the most efficient shipping route between Europe and Asia by 2050. That's just 26 years away. Canadians are, once again, called upon to meet the moment.
Right. One of the other interesting things that this policy puts in place is that it spans 20 years, so presumably many governments will see how long it lasts, and it will be reviewed and updated every 4 years, at least according to what this document says. So that's a good start, right? Because it's been a while since, it sometimes boggles the mind, having spent time in Afghanistan and so on, that we've reached this point. And it's easy to point the finger at one government, and we certainly can point the finger at this one. They did make budget cuts recently to military spending. How that factors into this, we'll figure out. And then the previous government as well didn't do great. Started off fine, and then kind of lost their mojo because it's expensive. You know, updating and renewing your military when you're not necessarily a military power is expensive. And if you're going to spend the money on the military, you're not spending it somewhere else. What gets you elected, right? Clearly, though, there's been a lot of pressure on this government of late to start to live up to some of this. And I think the war in Ukraine and the kinds of sort of deficiencies it's shown, at least our sort of ammo and so on, is part of it. But let's dig behind the numbers, because in of itself, you know, $73 billion over 20 years, up to 1.76% of GDP by 2030, you know, $8.1 billion over the next 5 years. Those numbers all sound pretty nice, right? But we wanted to dig behind them and find out what it really means. Will it have the kind of impact on the Canadian military that so many have been calling for now for so long? Dave Perry is one of them. He's president of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute, and he joins me now from Ottawa. David, thank you.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Well, this has been a long time coming, right? It seems like a bit of an odd day to release it, as everyone was sort of focused on an eclipse. But here we are. This has been in the, not to abuse the pun too much, but this has kind of been casting a shadow over this government for a while. What were you looking for in this policy?
Well, first, I mean, I think we can both agree that the jokes write themselves in terms of the timing of the release.
Sure.
And look, in terms of the overall policy, I guess I was looking at what this government was actually prepared to fund, bluntly, because I think the wider needs been pretty clearly articulated and had been by lots of people, including senior military leadership in this country. And the government had been sending, you know, signals fairly clearly, not just on this front, but across government, that essentially there wasn't a whole lot of money available. So I think that was definitely a frame. And given that as context, and noting that what was announced today was very heavily back end loaded towards the end of a 20-year investment window, which I think we can confidently predict that the current prime minister will not be the one in charge of delivering the 20th year of this plan, no matter what else happens, never mind what happens after the next election. A lot of this will be up to whoever wins the next election to start implementing the ideas contained in the document published today.
Yeah, I mean, you talked about back end, so people understand. I mean, when you see the headlines, it's an additional $8.1 billion in new defense spending over the next 5 years, an additional $73 billion over the next 20 years to raise our overall spending to about 1.76% of GDP by the end of this decade, at least, which is closer to that 2% than NATO's been looking for, but not quite there yet. But when you actually look into those numbers, what's behind, because the headlines will look fine, but what's actually behind those numbers, do you think?
So kind of two things. In terms of the time phasing, some of those big initiatives that were announced today, particularly the purchase of new helicopters for the Canadian Air Force, new tactical lift helicopters, very much a back-end loaded initiative, in the sense that almost no spending will happen in the first year of the actual investment policy. And just for context, for people that may not be familiar with the wonky way that we do these in this country dating back to 2008, what's tended to happen in these policy documents is that you get announcement of a bunch of different initiatives. The government's going to invest in this or that, or do make these increases to the size of the forces, etc., as well as the commitment of money over a two-decade time span. So this is in keeping with that. And they also release it using the Government of Canada's accounting method, which is uses accrual accounting for investment in expenses on infrastructure or capital equipment. And that basically means that what the government is announcing today is for a purchase of a piece of equipment or the construction of a building is the equivalent of somebody telling you the cumulative sum of annual mortgage payments they will make on their house over two decades. It's not the actual price of the house. It's not the actual annual expenditure. It is the cumulative sum total of two decades worth of investments between today and 20 years from now. Totally wonky way of doing it, but that's part of the trick to try and understand what they're announcing.
Yeah. I mean, I remember back to 2008, of course, different government, conservative government at the time, and they kind of developed a bit of policy, at least as far as their defense procurement was considered, developed a bit of fatigue pretty quickly, actually. I think one of the big issues that anyone looking from the outside in here is thinking is, okay, well, where's the money? Because we've heard about cuts already, to some extent, although the government didn't want to call them cuts. But we've heard about cuts. They were cuts. We had this conversation. They were cuts. So first you announce cuts and then you announce this. And I guess everyone's just trying to figure out whether this actually, you know, what is this going to look like in 5 years? Because we understand the military's problems are acute right now, whether it comes to recruitment and people in service and aging equipment and lack of sort of lots of other stuff.
So it's a little tricky to knit all that together. I was fortunate to participate in a briefing with some defense officials today. And so I asked what the cash spending numbers are for the policy, both on a five-year and 20-year basis. That's basically the investment that the government will make in the way that any normal human would understand it, not the sum total of the annual mortgage payments
right.
Format that they use. So on a cash spending basis, over 5 years, they're looking to spend a little bit more than $10 billion. And net new money as of today. I'll come back to the budget cut piece. Over a 20-year time frame, it's a commitment to spend a little over $100 billion on a cash basis. To go back to your kind of, how do you rationalize this with which were actually cuts, no matter what the other messaging around it said? that was announced in the budget in 2023. I saw Steve Chase in the Globe and Mail did a bit of quick math, which mm-hmm. checked out to me on my quick math on his quick math, that that 5-year impact of the budget cuts is about $4.5 billion on a cash basis. So if you're looking at a net additional $10 billion today, you kind of wash that through. You're looking at, if you wash out the cuts that they announced a year ago, add in the new money today, it's about a net $5 to $6 billion with rounding over the next 5 years. So it's new money, but you know, not earth-shatteringly new money in the short term.
Yeah. So if you add that all up, is this what we've been waiting for a couple of years for? It was announced with urgency a couple of years back in the budget that they were going to be coming out with this policy. Does it fundamentally address some of those real big problems we're seeing with the forces right now?
It addresses some, but not all. Right. So there's a couple of key things in here that I think they, in the document, they refer to as sort of foundational investments, which are, I guess I would characterize as important, but not sexy. About $10 billion in investments over the 20-year timeframe in the built infrastructure for the department. Department of National Defense, Canadian Armed Forces is one of the, I think, is the single largest owner of works, buildings, and structures in the
right.
in all of Canada, like 50-some thousand structures, many of which were built about a half century ago and need modernization to do many things, including replacing heating plants with something built in the last in some cases, 60 or 70 years.
Right. Anyone who lives near a base knows all about this, right? And I do in Victoria, of course.
Some of the infrastructure is elderly, to be kind. There's also about a $20 billion combined in money for maintenance, about half of that, like 9 and change for the Navy. And that's essentially money to keep our Halifax class frigates running until new ships come online to replace them. And then there's about another $10 billion for other maintenance. And those are two big pots. The maintenance funds in the department, especially as equipment ages, are always increasingly drawn on. So those are pretty significant investments, even though they're not flashy. And then two other ones I'd flag. We're making an investment in increasing our domestic ammunition production with our focus on artillery shell production in particular, and committing to basically get the Army up to what's a more realistic level of war stocks for an Army that might have to face the kind of conflict we're seeing in Ukraine. And what that would do is basically move our reserves of what are called battle decisive, i.e. the important munitions, from like a few days to something like more like a month. So that's right. A big initiative. And there's one other key one that I'd flag, a few $1 billion here in increasing our cyber capability, which is, I think, pretty important.
David Perry is president of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute. We're talking about the federal government today finally releasing a plan for the military, which earmarks about $8.1 billion in defense spending over the next 5 years. That works out to about five if you start doing the math, and an additional $73 billion in defense over the next 2 decades. So this really is a game plan for the next 2 decades. Of course, we've had a few of these. David, I was interested, I mean, of course, the name, Our North Strong and Free. Clearly, the Arctic was a big part of this. The Prime Minister went out of his way to mention that again today. There is some pressure on Canada to be seen to be doing something. What was the spend and the actual impact of what they've announced like for that very important piece of geography?
Well, that's where things are a little curious. I think actually, in part, like, you got to remember that not quite 2 years ago, but in June of 2022, the government released a very significant commitment of investments related to modernizing NORAD, which is basically an announcement of projects and funding without really releasing a policy document. I think in a lot of ways, that discussion of the Arctic and that context that we saw today is kind of the policy frame that would fit around that NORAD modernization announcement from a couple of years ago. Certainly because there's far more investment that was released that, again, to use this wonky accrual language, it was $38.6 billion over 20 years announced in June of 2022, just under $90 billion in cash-based investments, i.e., an investment framework that any normal human would understand. So that was real money. That was almost entirely oriented around our Arctic in conjunction with North American defense. So I think in a lot of ways, what we saw today, the language there as sort of the policy narrative to support the investment previously committed, there was one project in particular, a commitment to acquire airborne early warning aircraft in support of those other NORAD investments that was announced today. That's would be an enhanced enhancement to our capabilities there. That's a particular piece of equipment that we don't actually own or operate at present. So that would be an enhancement, as well as the commitment to add some additional underwater sensing equipment that could be used on our existing Arctic offshore patrol ship. So those are a couple of investments to support the Arctic, but I think the bulk of what's actually going to provide for that was already actually committed.
Right. The U.S. ambassador, I was wondering a bit about reaction from allies. I don't know if you had a chance to look over much of it yet. The U.S. ambassador released something that was fairly, I mean, it wasn't exactly effusive, but it was certainly complimentary.
To be honest, I've been wrapped up talking to lots of your colleagues today, so I haven't had a whole lot of time to see other folks' reaction.
Right.
I do think, though, so there's been lots of speculation that we're going to see an announcement this week. Might already have happened today. Like I said, I've been kind of swamped. Between this and the eclipse, that Japan will join Pillar 2 of AUKUS
as an additional right.
member yes. Of that new collaborative framework. To my mind, if Canada gets an invitation to join Pillar 2 of AUKUS, that'll really be the acid test of how our allies are viewing us, and then also what kind of reaction we see at the upcoming NATO summit this summer in Washington to mark the 75th anniversary of the NATO alliance. I think certainly we're still going to have a tough time, even though we're indicating spending additional money, multiple billions over 20 years. We're only going to reach 1.76% of GDP by the end of this decade, as you mentioned, and there's no plan here to get us to 2%. That's going to be tough to carry into a meeting with allies that have all committed to spend at least 2% of GDP on defense.
David, as always, thank you for your time.
My pleasure. Good to talk to you.
Police were called to the Kurt Cobain home at about 9 o'clock. They discovered the body inside an apartment above a detached garage.
He committed suicide, a shotgun blast to the head.
Outside the Cobain home, shocked fans held on to one another and reflected on the loss of a man and his music.
The age that we live in today, nothing to me anyways, means more to young people, our Generation X, whatever you want to call it, than music. And Nirvana obviously had something to say that was worth saying.
Yeah, that was King 5 Seattle's coverage of the death, the suicide of Kurt Cobain, which happened 30 years ago last Friday on April the 5th, 1994. I think a lot of people remembered that moment, specifically if you were of my age, because he was a huge influence for Gen X, sort of as Gen X rock and grunge kind of emerged from the shadows of everything that the boomers had loved for so many years and became kind of the voice of that generation. He was found in a Seattle mansion that he shared with his wife, Courtney Love, and their infant daughter, Frances Bean. Again, he had the 27-year-old had died from a self-inflicted gunshot wound. According to excerpts from a suicide note read at a memorial service days later by Courtney Love, Cobain took his own life because he no longer felt the passion to go on with his music. Nirvana with Cobain, bassist Chris Novoselic and drummer Dave Grohl had shot to fame with their second album, Nevermind, in 1991. We played Smells Like Teen Spirit, which was a massive hit, selling more than 30 million copies, thrusting the so-called grunge sound very much into the mainstream. Here are Novoselic and Grohl describing that time to Jimmy Fallon.
The whole thing was insane with Nirvana. Like in 1991, the band came out and like Geffen Records printed 50,000 copies of our record, which is like indie gold. And then it was just, it went multi-platinum. And then there was a time where you couldn't even buy Nevermind at the record store when we had CDs, right?
And that first tour that we did, we were booked into these places that some of them held like 90 people. Some of them were 150 people. And we'd pull up in our van. And because the album had come out and the video was on MTV and stuff, we'd pull up and there'd be so many people trying to get into the show that even when we had a gold record, we were still in a van with a U-Haul trailer. So it happened really quickly and it was really weird.
Yeah, I mean, I remember just how meteoric it was because I wasn't a huge rock fan. In fact, people I knew, I mean, they were rock fans, but the way that that song and that album just exploded into mainstream consciousness is hard to forget. Now, Cobain's very personal and angst-ridden lyrics made him, again, something of a poet laureate for Gen X, a generational spokesperson, they used to call him. And it did finally push that new era of rock to dominance, alt-rock, grunge, whatever you want to call it. Now, Cobain's personal struggles were no secret, including his battles with addiction and depression. And as they were enjoying chart dominance, as that Seattle sound was dominating rock with other bands that came as well, such as Pearl Jam and Soundgarden, Alice in Chains, Stone Temple Pilots, and so on. My next guest was in the early years of what would become the longest-running music show on Canadian radio. The Seattle sound and alt-rock was obviously a big part of the ongoing history of new music, and Alan Cross was on the air April 5th, 1994, when the world learned of Kurt Cobain's death. And the host of the ongoing history of new music on Chorus and the podcast of the same name, Alan Cross, joins me now. Alan, thanks for your time tonight. Much appreciated.
Oh, you're welcome.
How was your eclipse chasing? I guess most people east of Lake Erie, or more or less, went on a bit of an eclipse hunt today. How did yours go?
Pretty good. It was slightly overcast, but it wasn't enough to keep us from seeing totality. And we sat out in a couple of chairs. We took our dogs. The dogs did not freak out, and then we came home.
So pretty straightforward stuff. I mean, had you seen one before?
I had, 1979, February. I was in my very own backyard in Manitoba. I was in high school then, so it's. I remember looking in the paper saying, "Oh well, the next one I might be able to see is in 2024." God, that's so far in the future. I'll never make it that far, and here we are.
No kidding. Which kind of brings us to what happened. I mean, on Friday we marked the 30th anniversary of the death of Kurt Cobain. And I was listening back to some of the work that you'd done on the show because, of course, the debut of the ongoing history of new music kind of coincided with the very height of Nirvana's popularity. And then, of course, the suicide of Kurt Cobain not long after was a big moment in the show's early history.
Yeah, it was. I was on the air that day. It was a Friday, and I had a news person named Anita with me. And my shift ran from 2 until 6 that afternoon. And at 1:45, she came in and said, "Hey, they found a body in Seattle, and I'll keep you up to date on it." Now, this is, of course, before the internet, before social media, before email, before any of these things. So the only thing that we had in the newsroom back then was a telephone and a teletype. And Anita worked both to try and get to break the story, get the news as quickly as we could. And radio then was the only way to keep tabs on something important in real time. It moved faster than television. And I knew that afternoon, so many people would be listening to find out the very latest on what was obviously a very big deal to a generation of music fans.
Yeah, it's when we think back to it now, for those who weren't paying attention, maybe some people from the boomers, for instance, previous generations, or people who were too young to remember, the impact of his death to me felt like, I mean, the only one that I could sort of compare it to is John Lennon in 1980. And I was very young at that point, but you know, it spoke so much about just how influential Kurt Cobain had become in such a short period of time.
Yeah, he was a very big deal because what had happened is the music of Generation X had finally eclipsed the music of the baby boomers. All that classic rock, all that hair metal from the 1980s was swept aside very, very quickly in 1991 and 1992. And Nirvana was a big part of that. This was this new generation of singers, of songwriters, of rock bands. And Kurt had something special. He had the look, he had the sound, he had the image. Everything seemed to work. And when he died, it was very much like a John Lennon moment. The person who had been leading this particular movement, or leading this, you know, the biggest part of it in terms of image and style, was suddenly and very dramatically ripped away. So it was a big deal. People still come up to me, you know, 30 years later and say, "I remember where I was when I was listening to you on the radio and I first heard the news."
That's remarkable to think about it. I mean, how did you digest it that day? Because again, he had been such an important part, but his legacy, unlike say a John Lennon who had been in our lives for 20 years at that point, or a Elvis Presley who'd been around for longer than that, Kurt Cobain's legacy was still just essentially being built. You know, there was very little with which to hang a lot of information on. I mean, their rise had been pretty meteoric, and there was still so much more to come.
There was. Now, with Lennon, he had been out of the public eye for a very long time. And what people tend to forget is that although he was a Beatle, and for many people, he's the most famous Beatle, the Beatles really had drifted into, I don't want to say obscurity, but they weren't cool. They certainly didn't have the same kind of reverence that we have with them today. That didn't really happen until after Lennon died and until the compact came along in the 1980s. and began to bring back, you know, the glory of the Beatles. With Kurt, he was a person of the moment. And the fact that he decided to take his own life was different than being murdered like Lennon was. I mean, they're both horrible things. But there was something about the reluctant, tortured artist deciding to check out on his own that really impacted a lot of people. And before then, not a lot of people were talking about mental health in the music industry or mental health in musicians. And that was the beginning of it. Is, you know, somebody as successful and as famous and as critically acclaimed as Kurt Cobain could decide that he didn't want to do any of that anymore was pretty shocking. And I remember making the announcement thinking, this is Walter Cronkite talking about JFK. So don't screw it up.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, and when one thinks back to it, the legacy, you know, the amount of people that went to Seattle over the past week or so to pay their respects and so on, his legacy still stands so tall, considering, again, you know, it was a relatively short period of time that with which he was kind of a household name, at least in terms of creating music. I mean, it was a few albums, really, for those who weren't really into that kind of stuff. It's remarkable to look back now at just in how many ways Kurt Cobain's legacy has lived on. And one of them, again, was what you were talking about, was that idea of mental health and some of the idea of the tortured artist and what would have driven him to do this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there were only three albums and then some assorted singles and EPs. That was it. There wasn't a huge body of work. The Unplugged album hadn't even come out yet. It had only been recorded about 5 or 6 months earlier. So the that'll give you an idea of the importance that Kurt had. Now, the whole alternative thing, the Lollapalooza generation, the Gen X era of music had really only just begun. And for one of the leading proponents of this to check out this way was incredibly shocking. At the same time, it wasn't entirely unexpected because a month previous he had attempted suicide in Rome. And then before that, we had heard all kinds of stories about how unhealthy he was, and what kind of a drug abuser he was and all the rest of it. So when he did die, it was like, oh, this is awful, but it's not like we didn't see it coming.
Alan Cross is the host of the ongoing History of New Music. We're talking about one of the biggest names in new music, at least in the early 90s when Alan's show first debuted, Kurt Cobain of Nirvana, who died 30 years ago last Friday. There were events to mark that in Seattle on Friday and over the weekend. Alan, it felt like in some ways when that decade wrapped up, I think at the time we all thought of it as a new beginning for rock and roll, that Gen X was going to bring their sound into it. And suddenly by the end of the decade, even though there had been some huge successes for other bands sort of the same genre, whether it be Pearl Jam and Foo Fighters and so on, it sort of felt like that was the beginning of the end in some strange way. I don't know whether that's putting too fine a point on it.
No, that's very true. There was a sea change that happened in really 1991 when all the classic rock and all the hair metal got swept away very, very quickly, in a matter of months, if not weeks, by this new generation of artists. And that sound rocketed, rocketed up extremely fast. I mean, Kurt, for example, within a couple of weeks of Nirvana's Nevermind being released, the album was selling 300,000 copies a week when they expected it to sell 100,000 copies total. It was the number one album in early 1992. And then, you know, Pearl Jam and Alice in Chains and the Red Hot Chili Peppers and Soundgarden and all these other bands came through. And things really peaked in 93 and 94. We can go back, for example, as to the Woodstock 25 mm-hmm. festival in August of 1994, which was almost entirely a alternative leaning festival. Kurt had died a few months earlier, but there was so much momentum that it carried everything over until 1995. And then late 95, you begin to sense that the party is over and the music had sort of played itself out. The audience had grown up and moved on, and there was a new audience, this, you know, Generation Y, coming in afterwards, and the economy had improved. So the idea of this dour, glum, grunge music being the soundtrack to your life didn't fit anymore. You know, Bill Clinton was in the office, the Gulf War was over, the economy had gotten a whole lot better, so it was time for pop music to reassert itself. And I remember thinking when I first heard about the Spice Girls in 1996, it's like, uh-oh, that's it, this cycle is over, and it's going to be another 5 or 6 years before rock comes back.
Yeah,
that's exactly what
indeed.
Happened.
Yeah, we all put away our plaid shirts at one point there in the mid-90s. You've talked about this. You did this incredible series that you can find on YouTube called Nirvana by the Numbers. But it got pretty messy after Kurt Cobain's death. There was some real fighting over the money after that, unfortunately.
Yeah, there were a couple of things. Kurt was in the process of rewriting his will when he died. There was control issues over, you know, everything went to Courtney Love, but there were two other guys in the band, Chris Novoselic and Dave Grohl. And Kurt was the main songwriter, so most of the money and the control went to Courtney. And then that had to be all sorted out, and nobody got along very well. And it took a very long time for things to settle down and everybody to get their required piece of the action. So, it's not unusual that when a high-profile musician dies that a lot of people come out of the woodwork, or a lot of problems come out of the woodwork that need to be settled before anybody can move on. And that's what happened with Nirvana.
I was reading, obviously, there were a lot of sort of vox pops, as they're called, of people who were in Seattle over the weekend and on Friday. And a lot of them were my age. You know, they're sort of Gen Xers or early Gen Y. Do you think Cobain's legacy lives on in a really strong way for other generations as well? Or was it very much a moment in time? Because I think, of course, the influence of the boomers meant that artists like Janis Joplin and Jimi Hendrix and Jim Morrison lived forever, because we heard them as Gen Xers. We heard them growing up. We heard those stories growing up. And my dad lionized Jim Morrison. And I'm wondering if, because of Gen X's relative small footprint on culture in general, that maybe Kurt Cobain's footprint's a little smaller as well in the grand scheme of things.
No, I would say it's not. I read something just last week, as a matter of fact, saying how Gen Z has really developed an affinity for Nirvana and Kurt, simply because they grew up in an era where everything seemed to be fairly, you know, plastic as far as music was concerned, with TikTok and Instagram and YouTube videos. There's something that felt and continues to feel very authentic about Kurt. He was a true artist who played his own instrument, wrote his own songs, and dealt with his own demons in a real way. So, no, we're going to see Nirvana's music last for an awfully long time. Now, let's think about this. 1991, you're a, 15-year-old kid. The idea of you listening to 30-year-old music in 1991 would have put you into 1961. So, yeah. Pre-Beatles.
Yeah,
you would
Lawrence
not
Welk.
Be caught dead. Yeah, you wouldn't be caught dead listening to that music. But now you're 15 years old, you're listening to 30-year-old music, which would be Nirvana, Nevermind, and it sounds just fine to you.
Yeah. Alan, as always, thanks.
You're welcome.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his 6-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment, going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains, made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his 2-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone. Like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.